This podcast is a part of the Newhoff Media Podcast Network.
Good morning and welcome. We moved Senator Menard to this week because we were on vacation last week, and we appreciate his flexibility. Senator, how are you doing on this Wednesday morning?
Good morning, Brian. I'm doing well.
Good to hear. Good to hear. All right. 6 months into this, how are you and your family doing?
I just told Nick off air when I called in. Every day's an adventure. It's no different for us than it is for anybody. And my kids, being frank this morning, my kids are struggling with a hybrid schedule at school. I mean, it's a challenge for us and our family, but we're, you know, like everybody, we're putting our best foot forward every day, and we're getting through it the best way that we can.
Do you feel like we've lost some of that, if not ingenuity, the fortitude that the American people were sort of known for? It got us through the Depression. It got us through World War II. Got us through the Civil War. It seems like in this microwave society, we don't do well with long-term struggle.
Yeah, I think fatigue is certainly setting in. I think it is. But at the same time, Brian, I would tell you, I see examples every day in the district that I have the privilege of representing. I see examples every day of just people just plowing through it, not for themselves, but for others. And I think a lot of times those things just don't get the attention that they deserve because things are so polarized and, you know, there's so much division today in the country. But if you get down to the granular level, there's a whole lot of good happening. But I think certainly there is some fatigue setting in. I think my answer to your question earlier indicates that there's fatigue in the Menard household. But every day, you know, I tell my kids every day, we got to get through this, and we will get through it, and there will be lessons learned at the end. And we will, I believe, we will all figure out a way to be better when this is finally over.
All right. I've got a suggestion for you in your downtime, if you ever have any. You need to watch The Social Dilemma on Netflix. It is the most eye-opening, scary, terrifying thing I have watched in a long time about what social media is doing to us as people, and particularly with kids. And suicide rates, and September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and self-harm numbers. And it is told by the people who are on the ground floor who created all this, which is the terrifying part. It is an hour and 40 minutes that is a must-see for anyone, but particularly for parents.
Mm-hmm. I started watching it last weekend, and I got pulled away. So my plan this coming weekend, if I have time, is to finish it. I don't want to make any presumptions because I haven't watched it all the way through, but I think, you know, from what I've seen, especially in the last, I would say even before COVID, Brian, you know, in the last 12 months, in the last year, the impact of social media just on the daily decisions of a campaign who's, you know, any campaign, pick a campaign, not just Congress or the state Senate, but anybody running for office. Social media has become the most powerful, it's not a tool, it's, you know, the most powerful factor in any campaign at any level. And there's literally no check or balance to that right now. And there's so many things that are concerning to me about it. Put campaigns aside and put, you know, like you said, the impact that it's having on individuals and children. You know, the marketing of children, essentially, marketing children and their habits and their potential buying power as consumers. I mean, all of these things are big, big questions that we're going to have to face, hopefully sooner than later.
And I don't have a lot of faith in politics, you know, correcting this. Maybe I'm wrong. But the whole takeaway for me with this surveillance capitalism or even human futures or this prediction business and the consumer now being the product, right? I mean, we are now, we're not selling you a product. You are the product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Facebook, you know, I had this discussion the other day with a group of students, and I put it in these terms, and maybe it's a little extreme, but, you know, every time you click something on Facebook, you are essentially part of the profit-making scheme of what it is. Your use of it, you're clicking it, you're liking, you're sharing, and then how that's connected to what you do online that has nothing to do with your activity with Facebook makes you, as you said, the product. And you become the unpaid employee an unpaid employee of Facebook. You're working for Facebook. You're working for the social media giant, and you and your activities is what is making them enormous amounts of money. And you know, I try to check myself on this because, you know, this is a, you know, every day's something new with social media. But you know what what WSOY has to go through when you do, you know, when you put political commercials up on the air is completely different than what. Than what any social media or online platform, you know, I'm using air quotes here, platform has to do. So we have to have a little more balance in this equation because the direction we're going with Facebook, to me, is just there is very little good attached to society for that direction today.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, I'm not taking up for Facebook, but it's not the only one. I had the special agent in charge of the Springfield office of the FBI warn me about TikTok, you know, a year ago. And if there's anything worse than Facebook, it's the Chinese doing the exact same thing in America and having access to all that information.
Mm-hmm. It is, and it's a real thing. And, you know, I think it's a challenge to impress upon people how something that seems so harmless on its face can be really deeply troubling, not just to the individual or, you know, a teenager or a child, but to essentially questions of national security. You know, those things are like really big things to handle. And it's hard to equate, I think, those big questions and those big potentially really bad problems to something that seems so, you know, seems so innocent on its face. But we're going to have to right-size that.
All right.
We're going to have to right-size that.
Let's talk about being a candidate for a minute. Take your hat off. I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's red or blue or R or D. With early voting, you know, I'm thinking about the debates next week. Chris Wallace, mm-hmm. The moderator of the first presidential debate, announced the topics. You know, by the time the first debate takes place, a lot of people have already voted. Talk to me a little bit about the dynamic of just changing how a campaign is run.
Yeah, it's completely different. I mean, even compare this year to my first race for the Senate, which was in the summer and fall of 2012. It's completely different. Now, of course, some of that is heightened by COVID and the concerns with COVID. But there was a trend long before COVID of early voting, which typically in most states starts toward the end of September, the beginning of October. So campaigns adjust. You know, campaigns adjust accordingly, both sides, to the fact that individuals are making their minds up sooner. So that changes the dynamic of, you know, when do you start to communicate to people? When do you knock on doors? When you could do that? You know, when do you put things in the mailbox? Where does the candidate go? It changes the entire dynamic. The crescendo of a campaign no longer is the last week of October. It's now typically the beginning of October, early December, when that campaign really ramps up its activity.
I agree with you 1,000%. I'm not sure that all politicians are buying into this new way of doing it. And also, by the way, a lot of these politicians that are screaming about controlling social media are also using social media for their mm-hmm. own devices.
Yeah, I say this all the time. Politicians are no different than anybody else. They're gonna try to get away with whatever they can. You know, I've been through that in my campaigns, the most recent one with Facebook, and, you know, have almost coming to the point where I was going to file a lawsuit. But you're right there. You know, and it's also not just candidates. It's, you know, it's the paid consulting class that both sides of the aisle use to develop and to launch their campaigns. I think the adjusting on the side of kind of that pillar of what a campaign does, some are faster to adjust than others.
Yeah, and I think that machine, I wish politicians, I mean, this is a blatant call for supporting your local media, but if you want like radio shows and newspapers and TV stations to exist, the machine's got to quit paying people in Chicago mm-hmm. to run these campaigns.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I don't, you know, I do, I mean, one thing that, you know, this doesn't make me better or worse, and it just makes me, you know, how I do things, but I do hyper-local. It's a hyper-local campaign on my part, you know, my three races for the state Senate, because A, I think that's how you reach people the best. B, you have a tendency what you say is a reflective of who you are more so when you do it that way. I think voters get a better picture of the candidate when it's a hyper-local effort and you use as many local people as possible to do that type of campaigning on a paid basis.
All right, let's get to some stuff that's in the news. You've been recently encouraging area farmers. Talk to me a little bit about this crop program participation.
Yeah, so this came about with the University of Illinois and several partners in the ag industry a couple of years ago. So this would be the second planting season. Cover crops make sense for the farmer, for agribusiness, and for the environment. It's a really good match. It's a pretty simple thing to do. So what we're doing through the state budget is using just a little bit of money to try to incentivize more farmers to utilize cover crops during the off season. That helps reduce nitrogen in the soil. It helps reduce runoff. It helps stop erosion. It's not all on the state, by the way. The farmer has to invest quite a bit to do this. But at the end of the day, it's good for conservation. I've said, this is something that doesn't get said enough, some of our best conservationists and environmentalists are farmers. They are doing remarkable things at the local level to reduce energy consumption and to prevent erosion and runoff, which eventually gets into rivers and lakes and streams and the Gulf of Mexico. This, I think, has big potential for Illinois, and we're one of the leading states to promote this.
All right. Were you here in Decatur last week with the governor?
I was, yes. That seems like I had to pause because it seems like
a month ago, right?
Months ago.
Yeah, September 16th.
Yeah.
I feel like we're doing what we can here, but if you look at the difference in testing in Macon County versus Sangamon County as far as COVID-19 is concerned, I think I checked yesterday, maybe the day before, we had tested something like 36,000 residents, which seems like a gigantic chunk until you compare it to Sangamon County, which has tested 98,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so we've had many successes on testing. No question about it. You know, there was a point where the state tested 50,000 people a few days ago. We went from zero to 50,000 in 8 months. But we're still adjusting. I mean, that's a polite critique. I've expressed my concern early on. We had a conversation on the show about the inability for remote and rural areas to even get a test early on back in April and May. You know, you just couldn't get a test if you lived in a rural county. But we're still adjusting. And I think one thing that I've seen deployed now is mobile testing. You know, there's been mobile testing being moved very quickly. I think that's a good thing. But no doubt about it, the state and local public health departments are still adjusting as this goes on.
There's no consistency. I mean, that's this troubling thing is like, and I know that the president's taken a lot of criticism about not having a national plan, but even in the state of Illinois, counties that are sitting right next to each other, there's just no consistency.
Yeah, and here's why. Much of this depends on availability of tests. I think what the University of Illinois, by the way, is doing within, I would say, weeks, if not a couple months, is going to dramatically change testing. It's quite amazing. I was on a call with President Killeen, where he briefed me on what the university is doing and you know, the role Decatur is playing in that, frankly. It's going to change the entire world with testing. But the availability of testing, local partnerships, and how that interacts with positivity rates, how those things are reported, all of those make a difference. But, you know, what I would like to see is just, you know, we have permanent testing sites in as many communities as possible. We don't have that today, right? We're kind of a conglomeration of semi-permanent sites, a few permanent sites based on healthcare. But when you base it on that, that just takes a whole lot of people out of the mix because we know that some people just don't have access to those things.
All right. Tell me if I'm crazy, but on the November ballot, the first thing that people are going to have to answer is whether or not we stick with the tax plan we've had for decades, or we move to something that is entirely different. And I'm not spending a lot of time watching cable news, and I don't spend any time on a social media news feed at all. It seems quiet.
It is rather quiet. And I think this kind of goes to the conversation we just had, because much of the advertising for and against the fair tax proposal is being done digitally through larger platforms. I think a predominant piece of that is happening digitally. Now, I live in Macoupin County, so I get St. Louis broadcast television. Last week I saw quite a bit in terms of broadcast media proponent, talking about the proponents, the plus side of fair tax, I didn't see much negative. That was the first time last week. This week, I just haven't had time to flip the TV on at all.
Listen, I you know, we do digital advertising. It works. But if you just do it like we've done political ads, I mean, I just get so turned off by it. I mean, why can't people just give us honest information and let us decide? Or why are we just talking to the people who are dedicated left or dedicated right and already made up their minds on this stuff? Where's the information for people who are still open-minded about things?
Yeah, I gave, you know, I gave a suggestion. This has nothing to do with fair tax, but my suggestion to the state's effort with the census is, and this was right before Labor Day, was you have to get more local. You have to get into local radio stations. You have to get into local newspapers. Some small towns, actually many small towns, that newspaper is weekly, right? But people read it. They read it cover to cover, regardless of their political affiliation. And I think when I say we, I mean government, I mean a lot of business is just getting away from that. And that just leaves a whole lot of people that are untouched and untalked to.
Yeah, I think we're just constantly playing to the extremes. And by playing to the extremes, we're building the illusion that that's all there is. And,
yeah.
And you talked about a granular level. I can tell you in my day-to-day conversations after I'm done with this show, I talk to people of all political stripes and all backgrounds. People who are just trying to do good things in the community. There are open-minded folks out there.
Yeah. There are, and I mean, I go back to the, you know, I've said this many times on the show over the years, but when I started knocking on doors in 2012, I was surprised how many people said to me, I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican, I want to know who you are and what you're going to do. And I still believe that today. I still believe that today because Facebook advertising is geared toward an individual voter who has habits online, right? So you get in these bubbles, you get in these kind of bubbles that don't allow other opinions to permeate through them. They're protective bubbles around people in terms of what they consume online. And I don't think that's reflective of – I still believe this, still believe it. And there's probably people listening to me laughing right now in their cars. But I still believe that there are people that don't just get up every day – and there's people that are, but there's people that don't get up every day and say, you know, I'm so close-minded, I'm not going to listen to somebody who disagrees with me. I think there's still people that want to weigh, in this case, the pro and the con arguments of the fair tax and make an educated decision when they go into the ballot box.
All right. I've been on vacation for a couple of weeks, so excuse me if this question has already been answered, but when are we going to see the report on ethics reform?
So we actually have a caucus retreat today in Springfield, right? When I get off the show, I'm going to drive to Springfield and go to the caucus retreat. And today is going to be spent our caucus talking about it, what will eventually be an ethics proposal. I don't know when the report's going to be released. I would suspect pretty soon, but I would expect the Senate Democrats and the people who have led this conversation in our caucus, who have done a very good job, to have a proposal that I hope will be reflective of many, if not all, of the 9 things that I, you know, came out and supported several weeks ago. But the report, I don't have an answer, but I would expect in very short order some type of substance in terms of potential legislation, possibly for veto session in November.
All right. Food Drive is next Friday, October 2nd. We hope to hear from you or see you.
Yep.
We're going to do it in a very safe way. We've pared down the volunteer numbers. We're doing everything with protocols, and we're only doing cash and checks and credit card donations. But the need is going to be greater than ever.
It is. I see this every day. I keep in touch with local food pantries in my Senate district, especially in the rural counties. They are stretched. I mean, you know this, Brian, but I think I should say this. They are stretched to the max given the economic situation today. So on October the 2nd, everybody has to chip in here. Everybody has to chip in because everything that everybody chips in is going to end up in a home that needs it, and there are more homes today than there ever have been that need it.
Yep. Tell your buddies over there, instead of spending $5,000 on Facebook ads for a campaign where everybody's already made up their mind to feed some people.
Well, everybody needs to chip in on this. I mean, everybody needs to chip in because if there was one need, I mean, there's all kinds of needs we deal with in the district office, from unemployment to to problems paying a mortgage. But the one thing that we hear the most is, gosh, I really need to find a food pantry that can help me put some food on the table at the end of the week. We get that every single day in the district office. That's why October the 2nd, everybody's got to chip in.
Senator Menard, we appreciate it. Have a great day. Thank you, Senator Andy Menard. It's right there at the basic level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. That's it. Food, as basic as it gets.
Nothing more important. There's nothing more important than food.
You've been listening to the Newhoff Media Podcast Network. For more, visit newhoffmedia.com.